A leader of the extremist group Al-Shabaab in Somalia was killed in a drone strike. Pentagon officials confirmed on Wednesday that the group's leader in charge of intelligence and security had died in the airstrike. The statement said that his death will significantly impact the group's operational capabilities. The attack came about 300 kilometers west of the capital, Mogadishu, on Monday. Acting upon information from a reliable source, the Pentagon targeted the vehicle carrying the leader and struck it with drone-fired missiles. U.S. commandos killed another of the group's leaders in September.
The year 2015 marks the 70th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan is facing the task in key international meetings of urging the world to abolish nuclear weapons. Delegates from about 190 countries will gather in New York in April 2015 to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It will be the first meeting of its kind in 5 years. The A-bomb survivors will...
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, welcome back. Our first chat for 2015 will be with our man, Malachi Daniels. He is a France Fanon. I don't want to say expert, you know, so much. I don't want to put that pressure on him, but he's definitely coming from that analytical space. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And this is why I was glad I was able to get the brother on the line, because we want to talk about analysis. We know we got into the point now where we talk about Marcus Garvey without analyzing Marcus Garvey. We quote Malcolm X without really getting down to what Malcolm X was doing in terms of his progression, first as an individual, second as an activist, and third as an African. And I put it in that, you know, in that order, because he was an individual first. And, you know, the majority of his consciousness in terms of how he interacted with the world, whether he looked at it as an ism or not, was activism. He came out as an activist. He analyzed all the goddamn time. He went to the root, right? When we talk about radical, it comes from the Latin, radi, the root. What is the origin of things? This was part of his innate personality. You know, and this is why he was able to be drawn to the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad after he was able to get some discipline in terms of his personal self. And he was able to, you know, articulate what was happening around him. And this is what made him effective. And when I say, you know, in third, you know, his being in Africa, I know people are going to be offended by that. But that's what I'm saying. You know, you're not being analytical. The man was black. He was African. He was of African descent, no matter what he had done. If he had stayed Boston Red, you know, or Detroit Red, Newark Red, or wherever the hell he was operating, you know, he still would have been Malcolm. But the point is, Malcolm was a thinking human being, and I want people to understand this, and he was able to transcend being African. He knew who he was, and once he knew who he was, he was able to go to the table and be able to converse and be able to understand where this person was coming from, be they his opposition or be they his friend. You dig what I'm saying? He was thinking. He was a thinking man. And, you know, I see a lot of rhetoric that's going about, but I don't see a whole lot of analysis. Now, where am I going with this? Before I bring the brother in, is that Oprah Winfrey has made some statements, and Brother Daniels, I didn't hear the original interview, I didn't read the original interview, but I saw the banter that was going on in my timeline on Twitter. And of course you can follow me, The Angry Indian, one word, on Twitter. I'm looking at this, and people seem to be really heartbroken over Oprah Winfrey making the comment that, or alluding to the fact that she did, or the fact that she believes that there's no leadership going on in Ferguson with the anti-police brutality protests going down there. And she's obviously not paying attention to social media or whoever the hell does that for her. She's not paying attention to the meetings that have occurred between the White House and the Ferguson protesters. The Ferguson protesters and the local PD, the Ferguson protesters and the local sheriff's department, the Ferguson protesters, and I believe the local FBI office said, you know, it's like, where the hell is she on this issue? Obviously, she's nowhere. And she, like most people, of her stature and of her, I'm not trying to diss her or anybody else, but those of us who came from family that had to go to church every Sunday, you know what I'm talking about. You know, when we took Vaseline and slathered our faces with it, and our sisters had their hair always together, and we addressed people as Mr. and Ma'am. You know, we understand what Oprah's talking about, and what she's saying is, well, hey, I don't see anybody like me that's leading this. There's no Bill Cosby up there, because Bill Cosby has fallen from grace, right? So, you know, there's nobody like that up there, so there's no leadership. That's where she's coming from. And people are upset because she said this, because she's ignoring all of these young people that have stuck their necks out, that are getting rearrested and what have you, that are down there. You know, and we're going to talk about their perspective on this too, from what I can see about this. But that's one thing. The second thing is Bobby Seale, co-founder of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. He put out a paper saying, we do not assassinate cops. And I'm not going to go ahead and read the text. I encourage you to go look for it yourself. I'm going to repost it with this. We're going to add a link to that with this link. But suffice to say, he made a logical statement that, you know, black revolutionaries are not about going around shooting police. And what is this about? Because New York City police officers who were sitting in their squad car parked, who were not, you know, doing anything in particular. And I am going to point out right now, and we're going to bring this up with the brother, one was Asian, one was Latino, and that's a factor in this, okay? There's a factor on the street in this, and it's a factor politically, and we're going to talk about this. But I can't remember this cat's name right now, and it's not important right this second, but he just walked up and shot these two men to death. Now, earlier that day, he shot his girlfriend, right? Who is an active service military officer, but nobody in the media seems to want to point that out, you know. He thought that he killed her. He crossed the states. This was in Baltimore, I believe. Crossed the states, goes to New York and does this. Now, he was a maniac. This guy was wanted. He was arrested 19 times. He had a rap sheet as long as my arm. He was a violent son of a bitch. He was being implicated in killings and murders and assaults all up and down the eastern seaboard. But nobody's talking about this. Now, the same time that this happened, a white man in Florida shot a police officer, basically set him up and shot him, and then drove him to a pole. They got him. He's going to go to trial. This other cat supposedly shot himself. He won't see a trial. And the local PD there, the New York City Police Department, they have made it a point of issue to blame the entire anti-police brutality movement, not just in Ferguson, the entire, from coast to coast. They put this on everybody that is standing up against, you know, police brutality, all right? They personally blamed Al Sharpton, who we can criticize all day long, but not for this, all right? The mayor over there, Bill de Blasio, I should remember his name, you know, better, because, you know, I talk about him lately all the time, had in defense of him. Here, they're dinging him, you know, every way they possibly can. And now there's a slowdown I'm reading in New York, and it turns out that the crime is even lower. You know, nobody's doing anything. So it's like, what's really the hell going on? And, you know, Malachi Daniels, you know, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. And I wanted to bring this up. You know, people are upset with Bobby Seale because he's saying that, you know, black revolutionaries, black activists are not about running around murdering people, that, you know, we're not thugs, we're not terrorists, and we are not the ones you need to worry about, which is factual, because the majority of the people who are doing damage to police officers in the United States are white supremacists, white males, who are conservatives, who believe in Jesus Christ, and claim that they're trying to start a revolution. So we have Oprah and we have Bobby Seale at the start of 2015. What is your analysis on this?
Well, you know, thank you for having me back, brother. It's definitely good to talk to you. We've been trying to get back to have a discussion for a while now. It's good to be back and talk to you. I definitely wanted to touch on really quick, you know, in terms of why I use the handle on Twitter, Fanonian, simply because one of the things, you know, one of the foundations, I think, of Fanon's philosophy is that create your own analysis based on your own study and perspective, which is why I chose the handle Fanonian. Not so much that I'm an expert on Fanon, although I do constantly study Fanon. That's why I chose the handle Fanon, because I do believe that you must always challenge yourself to revolutionize your own analysis, you know, and be a perpetual student and constantly reassess your own analysis and actually create, in a sense, create an ideology based on your own observation constantly. So I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Okay.
But still, in terms of, you know, what's happening, you know, you have Oprah who makes this statement. It's unfortunate. There's a lot of things that we can ding her on, but this is not the worst that she's ever said in terms of the movie. You know.
Well, you know, Oprah Winfrey, you're telling me that people, and I saw some of the comments too, and some of the reactions, and I don't necessarily know why people are so shocked by Oprah's, you know, basically it seems as if it's a disinterest. You know, she doesn't really have a genuine interest because she doesn't really see much of a legitimacy in this current movement that's building. And it just seems that it's more so her generation or her class perspective and her being dismissive. That's what it appears to be, just based on what I gathered.
Like this whole thing that's going on with Bill Cosby, you know, a lot of folks were really, really hurt, you know, and it's like, obviously this is very emotional because a lot of these folks grew up watching the Cosby Show. So, you know, they got used to the idea that this is the ideal black family and that this is the leader, you know, especially after the pound cake speech, you know, cause a lot of people are still debating that one. You know, he took some facts. He took some facts. Well, you know, a lot of people failed and, you know, and such, and he was right. Now, I'm going to quote, Sammy Davis Jr. because I remember this. He made a statement in Florida to some black students. This was still during segregation because remember, he was a member of the Rat Pack. And,
right.
You know, there were times that, you know, Frank, you know, when there were mafia contacts, he could get him into certain places. And there were other times that he couldn't really do anything about it. You know, everybody talked about this after the fact. But when he was right down there, you still had a area called, Overton. That was a black community that was well-to-do. They were doing better. It was almost like Black Wall Street in Oklahoma. They were doing better than the white people who surrounded them. It was, you know, mostly people who were medical professionals. You know, legally trained folks who, if they weren't lawyers, they worked as CPAs and what have you. You know, people had jobs, they had decent homes, and, you know, they kept their school system pretty good. And it was a black community. And it was a thriving black community. But what ended up happening was Florida decided they were going to put a highway to increase shopping to get to downtown Miami. So they claimed eminent domain and just wiped out over it. But at the time, they had that split. This is before all that happened. And when he was down there, you know, this is on film. And he told these young people, he says, look, you know, a lot of folks are being lynched right now. They're being shot and stomped and beat to death. And if you don't take these opportunities, these doors, if you're not studying, if you're not preparing yourself to go out there and represent us, then those people died for nothing. And see, I never forgot that. And I try to, you know, impress on young people that I know you want to live your own life, and a lot of it has to do with the society in which you're raised, and I dig that. But a lot of folks, you know, really have squandered, you know, things out of laziness. But that's not who we're talking about. And when Cosby came up, he didn't give that kind of an analysis. He gave a condemnation in the sense that he did not analyze as to why it is failure. You know, in my case, my father never went past the fourth grade. You know, my mother never finished high school, you know. So, well, actually, she did finish high school, but she didn't go any further than that. So their understanding of the necessity and how to finagle and manage these things, how to apply for grants and or loans if you need to, and what have you. You know, things that white people take for granted. That was very difficult for me. I had to learn how, I had to open a bank account with a white girlfriend. She took me to the bank and you know, that's how it happened.
Okay.
Because I didn't have that experience in the house. So, but he didn't do this. It came down to condemnation, and you got the black Republicans and the people who do look down on us. The, you know, the people who believe that they're 400, like Oprah, who quotes, Madam C.J. Walker as often as she possibly can. Who became the first black millionaire and the first female millionaire in the United States from selling hair straightening products. And I saw black newspaper clippings at the time because there was a black press at the time. There isn't anymore. BET is owned by white people. But there was a black press at the time where black people said, I am not going to turn my back on my people by straightening my hair so I can do what the ad says, so we can wear our hair like the pretty white women. That's what C.J. Walker was pushing. So they talk about the money and the capitalism and how she was able to employ a lot of, you know, women, and they all had homes and grand homes because, you know, her daughter squandered all that money in Harlem.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, she was a party girl, and she squandered all that because she was there doing the Harlem Renaissance.
Okay.
And she blew all that that money. She knew all those people, you know, and she did everything that, you know, Paris Hilton would be doing today. The same thing. But see, you know, you got a lot of folks, and where I'm going with this is when, you know, who are pro-black, and I love them, and I understand them, but they will say, well, you know, you're not understanding something because black people don't do that kind of thing. We're not murderers. You know, we have a knowledge that is part of our DNA. It's part of our, right, what Leonard Jeffries talk about, sun people versus ice people.
Right.
And, you know, based on a book, you know, by somebody else, a Canadian. You know, I mean, where did these theories, you know, how did they impact an analysis on what Bobby Seale put out in terms of, you also had your thoughts on that, because a lot of folks are upset because he said that while I've met police officers that I've been able to liaison with.
Right. Well, you know, first, you know, I want to say that, you know, like I was telling you off the air, I was actually at the age of roughly around 18. I was actually brought into the movement by former members of the Black Panther Party, who had established an organization in New York City called the Black Panther Collective, which was actually a news service that had a paper before it became an organization. They initially, these were former Panthers that got together because they wanted to, you know, discuss and create form, you know, to disseminate information. Then, you know, obviously them being, you know, former revolutionaries want to actually provide services to the community. And at that point led to them actually inviting youth to join the organization. And then it actually became a political formation, which we, you know, we organized probably from the years of 94, 93 to roughly the year 2000, you know, and there were different iterations of that organization. But like I said, the Panthers in many ways are my family, because I did leave New York at some point and go to the Bay Area and definitely make contact with Panthers that were there and some of the commemoration organization that continues to work, the UEP Newton Foundation that also continues to work in the Bay Area. Also in Los Angeles, there's David Hilliard. Had a formation, also published a newspaper, and we both, New York and LA, got together to publish a Black Panther newspaper for probably about 3 years for a period, short period. So my take on Bobby Seale, is first, I'm not surprised at Bobby Seale's analysis at all. It's very, very much, what a lot of the young brothers and sisters who have bought into the romanticization of the party and the image of the party is, they don't really understand what the political tenets of the Black Panther Party were. They never really got into, most people don't get into actually what the disciplines of the Black Panther Party were. And you see that very clearly in what Bobby was saying. You know, the Panthers were definitely, they were not, as Bobby Seale likes to say, he refers to the Black Panther Party as, they were a black intelligentsia. I would say that was the truth. In many ways, they were definitely, the vanguard in that respect. The party was definitely about, creating a means to, drive black issues into legal spaces to challenge policy. And so in the comments that you see by Bobby Seale, you see that very clearly. My disagreements, as I had said to you on Twitter, my disagreements with it is the lack of it seems that there's a bit of ageism that's a part of Bobby Seale's statement, where he seems to be somewhat disconnected by the impact of, even though it's the image of the party, but the impact of revolutionary heroes to black people, and specifically a black youth, the image of the party of being defiant in the face of racist police attacks on black people. And so I think it's a hard thing to feed to black folks in that letter, and telling black folks, well, the Black Panther Party did make compromises with police, it makes it appear that way, when that wasn't really the case.
Yeah.
You know, the party, listen, if you, and Bobby Seale says in his letter, read my book, Seize the Time. And I did. That was one of the first quote unquote revolutionary books that I read. And in that book, Bobby does tell some stories about the very early days of the party. The very defiant and fiery, some of it what we call lumping proletariat behavior, you know, where brothers getting into street fights and scrapping to establish dominance, some of the early party members, you know, a lot of these brothers did spend some time in jail and did spend a lot of time on the street. So in order to actually be on the street and organize amongst the people, you got to be a little bit rough, you know, and it does involve a little bit of machismo and sexist and what would be perceived today as sexist and misogynistic behavior, in order to reach people who were a bit thick-headed in terms of getting political study.
Yeah, well, that's the way the 5% Nation arose. Because right. A lot of folks are like, oh, well, you know, he was a sellout Muslim. He couldn't handle the discipline. Well, you know, I've always believed that there was a degree to that yeah, he couldn't handle the discipline, which means that he realized from his own visceral experience that there was a whole lot of other brothers that could get certain aspects of this, but didn't have the discipline.
Right.
Didn't have the
discipline. And so, not to cut you off, but my only thing, I think it was right and principled for Bobby to say categorically that, you know, that, revolutionary movements are not about assassinating police officers. Things like that should be obvious, but it needs to be said. It needs to be said because maybe a lot of young cats feel like that's the case. And if they do feel like that's the case, then they're not as knowledgeable as they may think they are. And if that's the case, then you need to do the study. You know, and that has been my criticism. The New Black Panther Party, I had some dealings with them. I met with Khalid Muhammad during the period where he was alive. The Black Panther Collective did have a meeting with Khalid Muhammad during the time when he first established the New Black Panther Party wing in New York City. The Panthers who brought me into the movement of the original party would not deal with the New Black Panther Party, largely because of the use of the name initially, which is not entirely correct on their part, but the rejection of the study and the principles of the Black Panther Party. So that I understand. And I personally don't deal with that organization because I see it as, you know, an affront to the legacy of the party to not engage in the study and the principles of the party, but take the name. You know, so it needs to be put out there. Bobby Seale needs to put these things out there. But at the same time, sort of like, I guess, the Bill Cosby condemnations in the past, there needs to be a certain level of empathy, especially someone like Bobby Seale, who is such a powerful revolutionary figure in the Black community. You know, people look to Bobby Seale. He's, you know, whether the party gets into deification of revolutionaries or not, he's a revolutionary hero. You know, and we need to feel like Bobby Seale, the youth especially need to feel like Bobby Seale empathizes with the brutality and the savagery that they're enduring. And I'll tell you, brother, my comparison, and a lot of this comes out of my comparison of working in the Bay, organizing in the Bay Area and organizing in New York City, the OPD versus the NYPD, mm-hmm. Same animal, but two different kinds of beasts, if you understand what I'm saying.
All right, because like I'm looking here as you're you know, talking about this, because like right. I said, you know, the thing with Oprah, I mention it because it does seem to be, you know, two extremes of like it to the point where, you know, Black people are just so mad they don't know where to go. But they don't want to listen to anybody. Even if they're Black, they actually, you know, say, hey, maybe we need to think about this and really look at it. Folks are so fucking frustrated. And then you have a lot of, you know, Black power advocates or RBG, whatever the fuck, who they just want what the fuck they want. And when I sit like you, when I sit with them and I say, okay, man, why don't you actually, between you and me, give me an idea of how you deal with education, infrastructure, government structure, foreign relations, how to deal with the petroleum issue, how you're going to deal like with Israel, this, that, and the other. I mean, fellas have actually said to me, man, looked at me wistfully and said, man, we're Black, man. It's just going to fall together. It's just going to work.
Well.
And I'm just like, nah, man, you know, and then they get irate. You know what I mean? Right. And like I said, I've been in some situations where I really didn't think I was going to get out of the room because, you know, folks really change. You know, they're like, oh, I heard your show. And the thing about it is they'll tell me that the way that they got the show was from, like, you know, I'm not trying to offend any of my listeners, but from a white source.
Right.
From a European source, usually a conservative source. Right. And they're like, well, hey, man, you know, fuck Israel. And I'm like, you don't hear me say fuck Israel. Yeah, but you give an analysis about what they're doing in Palestinians. I'm like, yeah, but it's not fuck Israel because they're Jews, man. I'm saying fuck Israel as a political entity. And then they start getting into that Illuminati shit. And then it's like, but where are you getting this? And then it's from the same source that they said that they heard about me. And it's like, well, wait a fucking minute. You know, we have a lot of cherry picking that goes on. But see, you know, one of the other things I wanted to talk about was like Marcus Garvey. I mean, I see Marcus Garvey as, in one sense, perhaps in many senses, in terms of government and movement structure, the best success and one of the worst. Nobody else has ever organized that many Black people internationally before.
Right.
He was able to do that, which is what made him so fucking dangerous. I mean, this is how J. Edgar Hoover made his career. was going after Marcus Garvey. But at the same time,
exactly.
When you really study, that's how he built the FBI. But when you really look at Marcus Garvey, and I'm talking about listen to the family members, read the critical stuff on him from people who were with him, he didn't take advice very well. If he took advice at all. Because he really he had vision. If he got the idea from you that you didn't see what he could see, he didn't have time for you. You had to agree with him. His children were like, look, my father was stern, you know. He got up every, one of his sons is on film. He said, I can't even remember not seeing him in a three-piece suit, no matter what the weather was. He believed, and this is not a knock, I'm just saying, this is how human beings get. He believed that he was the only person around him, anyway, that could see forward. And he had good reason to suspect that. Because there were a lot of people who were angry, but nobody had a plan. They really couldn't politically see themselves anywhere. Now, he was a product of his time period. He looked at, you know, a black empire. Am I right or wrong about that?
That's what I gather.
That's what I get. You know, I mean, he talked about literal kings and queens, and they had very grandiose ceremonies and everything.
UNIA?
Garveyite. You know, a lot of my family's in the NOI. A lot of family, you know, still Garveyites, even though the organization exists. I mean, they politically don't have any weight. But what I was trying to get to was, he believed in the idea of presenting himself as, well, he said that he was the unofficial unelected president of Africa. I mean, this is not an exaggeration. He said this. But he believed, the way he understood black people, right, especially at that time period, that there had to be a leader, that there had to be somebody that they looked up to. And he and his wife and their children walked around regally. And anyone who's done the research, the parades that they used to have in Harlem were grand.
Right, that's Garvey's famous quote is, you know, when he was criticized for those parades, was that the people, you have to give the people pomp and circumstance. That's how people react to that.
Exactly, brother. And he was, you know, to the minds of white people, if people knew that you were a Garveyite, now you could lose your job or they would be afraid of you. This was before the NOI got to that level. You know, that those men, you know, like I said, you know, these older people that I knew, they said, yeah, my father had a uniform that he would wear to those meetings. And he would stand up tall, you know, when he got on the bus to go to the meeting. And white people would see him and other black folks wearing that uniform. And, you know, it meant something to black folks. You know, there was something that they could see. But the point is, you know, how many of us, politically, I'm talking about human beings now, get stuck in that. And we never go any further. Someone was talking to me about communism the other day. And we got into a debate because he was saying, well, such and such was a communist state, you know, talking about Cuba. And right. I made the argument that, yeah, you know, we talk about communism and we talk about, well, this is communism. And then, you know, communists will get uptight and say, well, Stalin wasn't really communist, you know, which is a reasonable argument. But we never really talk about who amongst the communists were the ones that rose to the top in terms of brute force, not because they had a better program. The liberal communists were pushed to the side.
No, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, it isn't often discussed too often amongst communists. You know, and I've spent some time, you know, with the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that's generally not a part of the discussion.
Well, they don't talk about racism either.
No, they don't. They don't.
You know,
they
that don't. Was, yeah, that was the main bone of contention between the Black Liberation Movement, be it the Black Panther Party or anyone else, Black Action Group, whoever the hell, the idea that, you know, under communism. I mean, same thing with the Sephardic Jews in Israel who founded the Black Panther Party of Israel. You know, a lot of people, they don't know Arab Jews and Sephardic Jews over there founded their own Black Panther Party in the 60s after Bobby Seale went there and had a chat with them. And they were anti-communist, not because they were really against the politics per se, but they were against the idea that everyone had to become a race-neutral proletarian and then join the revolution.
Well, you know, many people of color have, you know, that's the, you know, that's the bone of contention. You know, whenever my discussions, you know, that I've had, because I dated a sister who was with RCP, and these were, and she was from Kenya, and these were the discussions that she and I would get into. She was in an Americanized, indoctrinated Kenyan, you know, and then on top of that, she was a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. She accused me often of romanticizing African culture as a black man.
Well, yeah, but she has a point though, and see, and this is what I was getting to. You know, I don't, when I see the analysis, I'm not hearing any of the older heads who are part of some of the audio podcasts and black radio shows that I've heard since this, you know, since the new year has started and since this controversy has gone on, that has actually said, well, you know, the political and international situation in 1968, 69, when, you know, people are looking back, well, Bobby Seale said this, Bobby Seale said that. They're not relating to, this is 2015. We have a completely different situation. You know, you had SWAT to deal with, which was a byproduct of the Nixon, you know, war against black America by, you know, claiming to start a war on drugs.
Right.
But then at the same time, you know, you didn't have local police forces that were being trained by the Israeli Defense Forces and Mossad and Shin Bet.
This is true. You know, and I, you know, I tell you, I hear your, you know, your criticism of folks. And again, you know, going back to Bobby Seale's letter, I definitely see the point and the necessity of Bobby Seale to make that kind of statement. And I'm glad that it did come from him.
Yeah, so am I.
You know, I tell you, but I think on both sides of that argument, obviously sort of like the, you know, the black folks who we're talking about, who need to hear this kind of thing, who need to maybe obviously look a bit deeper into, the history of the organizations that they romanticize and the study of the organizations they romanticize. At the same time, I you know, I tell you, brother, you know, coming back home to New York City and visiting my mother up in Harlem and going to Harlem to see the kind of basically Gaza-like atmosphere in Harlem that happens when the sun goes down. You know, the, you know, how, you know, civil liberties and the Constitution, that's thrown completely out the window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's interesting, you know, as an older man now, the cops approach me in a different way and I'm able to deal with them in a certain way. You know, all I need to do when they approach me is, you know, throw out a few organizational names like the Center for Constitutional Rights and various other names. And they tend to cower because they don't expect that to come out of my mouth. But I see how they indiscriminately deal with black folks who, you know, don't know those key catchphrases and the legal jargon and organizations. And it's an atmosphere that it's a normalized apartheid atmosphere where it was obviously a siege atmosphere in the black community in the 60s and early 70s. It's a normalized atmosphere of fear. And it basically is. It's an apartheid Jim Crow kind of atmosphere because everybody accepts it. You know, they accept it even though they bitch and moan about it, but it's an accepted atmosphere. It's like, it's become like, it's the oxygen, it's the air you breathe, you know, and that makes it more terrifying than it was in the 60s. At least that's my perspective on it.
But it's just this jump to, you know, well, fuck Bobby Seale now, but I'm going to be upset about Oprah and we need to talk to her. You know, like they aren't, you know, displeased them, but fuck mm-hmm. Bobby Seale. And I'm like, wait a minute. Bobby Seale was out there his whole goddamn life. And yeah, we can mock him for cooking with Bobby and shit like that and pop it up on TV to cook some pork ribs. But you know, the fucking thing is he, like you mentioned earlier, there are people who are actually out there, people who are still in there.
Right.
And then, you know, with this shit with Asada Shakur going on right now. And in my opinion, Jay-Z's connection to what the fuck is happening with this whole fucking Cuba thing, he's connected to this shit. You know, that's my personal feeling because, you know, the black community did not have the political savvy to ask him, why is it that the bounty went up when you went down there? And how did you get down there? Being you got to have...
Well, that was my initial question. How does he get to go on vacation in Cuba?
In Cuba. You know, it's like, how the fuck does that work? How the fuck does that work? You know? How the fuck does that work, man? And you look around and you're just like, hey, you know, nobody else can fucking go there. If a white activist down there that they didn't like, who was on the far left or some shit, or somebody they assume is on the far left, it went, you know, Fox News would be calling for that motherfucker's head. And if they were connected to Obama, there's no way. There's no way. Nobody will let that go. But in this case, the black community never asked itself. Most of them don't even know who the fuck Ashada Shakur was. And you know what? Just for argument's sake, brother, could you give us a quick rundown on the case of Ashada Shakur and how this relates to police brutality?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, Ashada's, you know, I guess most people don't know Ashada's case. You know, Ashada, you know, was forced to go underground with some other comrades, you know. By that time, there were several Panthers underground, under the auspices of the Black Liberation Army. Ashada, I mean, I encourage people to go and read, but there was a state trooper that was shot. Ashada was pulled over with some other comrades on the New Jersey Turnpike. But it's very clear that Ashada did not shoot this police officer. There was a manhunt for Ashada. She was eventually apprehended, and she was, actually freed, by some white comrades, and they got her out of the country.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Sekou Odinga. We have to mention that name too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have to, mention Sekou, who was actually, recently, you know, we can't say freed, you know, although that's what he was, but, you know, I have trouble seeing it that way because, you know, a political prisoner, obviously he shouldn't have been there to begin with.
Begin with, yeah.
You know, in terms of Ashada, I mean, I guess, you know, are you talking about the bounty? Do you want to discuss the heightening of the bounty of her being placed on the FBI's most wanted list?
We can talk about all of that, man. You know, this is the type of analogy. You know, people are waiting for Don Lemon, and this is where the Obama crowd is coming from. Actually, the Obama and Oprah crowd are coming from because they represent that class. They represent that class. And what she's saying is there's not an Obama down there that's on the Oprah show, that's on Tyra Banks' show. She still has her show. You know, does not doing, you know, the acceptable Chitlin circuit to talk about what was happening down there when she's had, I don't know how goddamn long to talk about every 28 hours to talk about a lot of things. She could have talked about Lavina Johnson and she doesn't want to talk about the average black woman out here getting fucked over because, you know, she's not going to bring up a Marissa Alexander, but she could have talked about how this vet, you know, this soldier, you know, winds up raped and dead and nobody's doing anything about it. She could have talked about that, but she didn't talk about that.
I haven't seen that discussed on any mainstream news outlet anywhere.
Yeah, just Democracy Now! For the most part, and some bloggers, some feminist bloggers who have laid on it. But there's a lot of black women who haven't talked about it, even those who have told me they were aware of the case. And it's like, well, no one else is really talking about it and such and so on. And it's like, look, I understand what you're saying because I've been trying to get traction on the Ronald Ritchie case, right, since that thing happened. Nobody seems to give a goddamn. You know, here it is. John Crawford's girlfriend dies in an accident here on New Year's Day. You know, people are suspecting that it wasn't an accident because everybody knows that she was hounded by the police. This was reported the day her man got shot. So, you know, so they could get one story out that they wanted to, and they ended up dropping all the charges on the police anyway. And I've also been trying to no effect at all to get anybody, white people, any goddamn buddy, to talk about Angela Williams. This was the white woman who had a heart attack and died in front of her children when John Crawford was murdered. Nobody's talking about that. Yeah, you see what I'm saying? You didn't know about this?
You know, actually, I hadn't heard about that since actually the shooting. I haven't heard that mentioned actually since it actually happened.
You would think a white woman dying, they would be in front of her children, would be, you know, for, you know, front page news, but it isn't. And this is what I'm saying. You know, black folks are not looking at the news critically. They'll just say, oh, well, all of the news lies. Well, that, of course. Well, this isn't really a democracy. Of course. But they don't go any further than that. It's just rhetoric. They don't really understand these things. And when I try to get them to get into a real conversation, you know, I don't know what your particular experience is with this, man. But then it's like, I'm trying to belittle them. I'm talking down to them. You have to understand that I haven't read what you've read. And it's like, well, all the more, yeah, I think you should, you know, take what I'm saying to heart and look up the sources that I'm telling you so you can see for yourself.
You know, when I do get the opportunity, man, there are certain people that black people do look to. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's folks in hip hop. And most of the time, folks in hip hop and celebrity folks don't have any level of political education whatsoever. And the ones that should know better, I'll name names. I love Chuck D, but my exchanges with Chuck D have really surprised me. You know, and what it speaks to, you know, obviously not saying that Chuck is not a knowledgeable person. Obviously, Chuck has got a great deal of life experience and knowledge, and I'm sure he has a level of study under his belt. But in my exchanges with him, you know, I try very hard to find out exactly where he's coming from and what he's trying to actually direct the youth who may listen to him. You know, and what political direction is he trying to guide them? You know, I'm not really clear. And then there are a lot of folks like him. I'm trying to understand. You know, and even someone like Professor Griff. I like Griff. You know, I don't think I've ever had any personal exchanges with Griff, but I think because he's such a charismatic brother, and he does have a lot of knowledge, I think, you know, he should, you know, because we know our people are religious people, you know, we're very religious folks. And if we are given an opportunity, we will grab onto something and become religious about it.
Yeah.
And usually it will be something that won't challenge us, you know. So discussing the Illuminati and those kinds of things. And I'm not saying there isn't any validity to that, but actually focusing on that obviously is very detrimental. It doesn't really do anything to move us forward or the conversation forward, whether it be the discussion of white supremacy and how it affects us in our day-to-day lives, whether it be imperialism, colonialism. You know, those discussions really don't move that conversation forward, and it definitely doesn't change our reality. And I'm sure Griff knows that. You know, so the criticism is, you know, and it's a political criticism. It's not a personal criticism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a political criticism that the study needs to be more focused on the concrete, the bread and butter, you know, and actually getting the youth to actually, like you were saying earlier, to actually see themselves at some point and positioning themselves, not just as activists, which is obviously very important, join an organization, but seeing themselves beyond that and actually affecting the political movements of their people. And maybe even eventually positioning themselves as leadership, not opportunist leadership, but real leadership, and actually figuring out, like you were saying, how do you build infrastructure? You know, how do you create these, you know, international networks of African people, you know, where that we can have, you know, an economic system outside of this current economic system, if that's what we choose to do, you know. And so these other discussions obviously they're not going to, you know, get us to that in any way, shape or form. And if our youth are not only thinking about the Illuminati and, you know, and the Bilderberg group, and not from a concrete standpoint, you know, but from a conspiratorial standpoint, it's not going to get us anywhere near where we need to get to.
Yeah, I mean, is pretty much, as far as I'm concerned, you've hit, you know, the nail on the head. That's where I'm at with this. You know, we get into this point where, at least, you know, where my criticism is, and I know I'm, you know, people feel like I'm really beating, you know, a dead horse with this, but I just think that it's really important when I'm talking to somebody and they want to look at Christopher Donner, you know, as the new Nat Turner. This is what people were saying to me. Remember all the hype about that on the street? Oh, man.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, man, he gonna show them motherfuckers what we about, nigga. He gonna show them niggas what we fucking about, man. And it was like, hey, that motherfucker, did you look at his career when they finally talked about his jacket? This is somebody who was photographed with William Bratton.
Absolutely.
Who's connected to all this shit in New York, right? So, motherfucker, we look at him, special, you know, Naval Special Warfare Division. What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. What does that mean?
What does that mean? You know, LAPD, right?
No, my thought was just, you know, how many Africans or Asians did he kill? You know, and obviously, you know, as you know, obviously as black people, we look at Dorner's situation and how they eventually dealt with him. From a historical perspective and how historically black people in general have been dealt with. And I guess this connects to the Bobby Seale statement on, you know, and I can't recall the brother's name who shot the two cops, unfortunately, and I apologize for that. But Bobby Seale's, comment on it being, that this brother was obviously, mentally unstable. You know, he had shot a black woman before he arrived in New York.
His girl. His girl. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how do you shoot your woman, man?
Right. You know? And you know, and one of the things I immediately did, you know, and, you know, as best I could was comment on, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and to let brothers know, listen, you know, we can't, not only in shooting a black woman, it's like, you know, I mean, that's the first thing that can't in any way, shape or form. Can that be considered a revolutionary act?
Hell no.
You know, when you murder one of our people, you know, I mean, you can take out a whole precinct and it's still, you just nullify. If that can be seen as a revolutionary act in direct response to police murder of unarmed black men, women, and children, immediately it nullifies everything. It nullifies everything. You are a reactionary nut. You're dismissed as a reactionary nut, and that because that's what you are at that point. You're not doing anything. You're not doing it for us.
Nope.
You know, because you sure enough didn't do it for us when you shot a black woman. And these are the things that Bobby Seale is trying to, I guess, in a very matter of fact way and very succinct way, trying to impart is that, you know, as a revolutionary, you live by very specific principles. And when he did talk about the times that they got into shootouts, it was for self-defense. It wasn't going on the offensive about killing cops.
Exactly.
And to touch on it, there's a divide in the party. Obviously, people know about the historic divide between the East Coast and the West Coast. The West Coast, many of the leadership disagreed with the formation of the Black Liberation Army, which was largely the East Coast and particularly New York wing of the Black Panther Party. Again, we can, you know, debate, you know, all day long about whether the BLA did, if there was any validity to some of those actions. Obviously, when you're dealing with the paramilitary police force, a racist paramilitary police force, there are going to be violent responses to those actions. But largely ideologically, the West Coast did disagree with the formation of the BLA. So some of Bobby Seale's, statements do come out of that, you know, because there was more of a cultural nationalist bend to the East Coast, wing of the Black Panther Party. Whether or not that's the reason why the BLA was formed, I wouldn't go so far as to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it was a natural, to me, politically speaking, you know, from a historical standpoint, it was a natural evolution, because you had the deacons for defense before that.
Right.
And you had that, you know, because a lot of people are really confused about Geronimo Pratt. He was never a Black Panther. He was training the Black Panthers. And, you know, I'm privy because of my family's, you know, history as educators to know, you know, and being like you, you know, from Philly, you know, on the East Coast, and being Gullah, that we had a group of elders in the South that were running a totally different government that white man didn't know about. They're just finding out about this now because these people are all gone. But Geronimo Pratt was like, we can talk about this now. There was a circle of elders in the South that was directing a completely different movement. And he said there was a handful of people who were like me that came back from Vietnam that went around to help, you know, teach groups like the Panthers how to organize. But it was never, well, we're going to have this major uprising. That was never the program. The way that, you know, Pratt and other people have transmitted the information, and the way I got it was, there was a government in the United States that was underground that had two factions. You had Robert Williams in Tanzania, you dig? And then you had, you know, because he came, where did he come from? Where did the Deacons of Defense come from?
Which state was that?
Well, there were different chapters. There was one in Alabama, there was one in South Carolina, there was one in Georgia, you know. I can't even tell you exactly how many, because that's how underground it was. And the only reason I even can impart any information at all is because of Geronimo Pratt. And, you know, things that I had heard growing up that I've been able to connect, that there were, you know, the Deacons for Defense was, you know, what was known in terms of, you know, a little bit of an armed wing of resistance against the Klan. And
right.
The white citizens councils and shit in the South. But they didn't just come up on their own. They were directed by a group of elders that I understand was made up of men and women. And I'm saying elder in the traditional African sense, who were looking at what you and I have both been pretty much, I believe where we're coming to, that there was a plan for what would happen if we were free. When we get free, what will our world look like? And see, Oprah has an idea of that. But she gets, when you mentioned romanticism, that's a good goddamn word for this conversation. And I've used that word with a lot of Black people. And brothers and sisters, I'm not saying that you're stupid, but it is not a word that Black people use in common parlance. It is a term, though, I pick up from my white homies. You
okay.
Dig what I'm saying? And, you know, romanticism, where we look at the past or a particular period or a particular era or whatever fantasy we got going on in our own head as being a litmus test from where we look at the entire world. Now, most white people come from a Europocentric position. So they have a Europocentric perspective. And for those white people who are not in Europe physically, not on the subcontinent, but in North America, in Australia, in New Zealand, wherever else, Canada, wherever else that, you know, the Anglophone world is, they come from a Eurosettler perspective. You know, they are white people who are in places where they do not have an Aboriginal fucking title, yet they rule. How did they rule? You know, so we have our Afrocentrists, and we have some that are conscious, like Brother Malachi, who looks at things and says, yeah, Africa was not perfect. Africa is made of human beings. But you got other people who say Afrocentrism. Well, you might as well be talking to a Black Nazi. It's the same goddamn thing. There was no homosexuality. There was no murder. There was no crime. There was no starvation before white people. You know, really ridiculous goddamn statements that are being said to young folks that are trying to, you know, who are just being overloaded with information and goddamn video games. And I'm being very serious about this. Having a hard time being able to tell the difference between the two.
Mm. You bring up an interesting point. And for me, one of the most interesting things about Twitter is being able to observe that there are a lot of grown people who are walking around, not just the youth, who really have a hard time differentiating what reality is and is not.
Mm-hmm.
You observe that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, social media especially, because they're more tech savvy. So, you know, they know how these things work. And, you know, the one thing about the internet, I don't care what you're into. You know, I'm not trying to insult anybody or be vulgar here, but if you're into breast milk, you know, and not as an additive or trying to get information so you can, take care of your child, but as a fetish, if you're into that, at one time, there might have been newspapers, you know, in very select, newsstands, right? In major cities for that kind of thing. You might have like some mail order or whatever the hell for information on that. Now you can go on Google and get whatever the hell you want. So, you know, you get a lot of information. So you hear a lot of brothers when they see Alex Jones, you know, and I asked some people, just so I wouldn't just have my own opinion, I wanted to ask them. I said, what is so exciting about Fox News? Because the majority where I reside, the majority of black people that I know that bother with news at all watch Fox. Mm. And, you know, you ask them, why do you watch Fox News? Or why do you listen to Alex Jones on the internet? And you know what it is, man? They're excited by them. They're excited by Glenn Beck because he acts crazy. Because Sean Hannity acts tough. That's what motherfuckers told me. At least Sean Hannity doesn't act like a faggot. And I'm like, what do you mean? Don Lemon's a faggot. You mean he's gay? Well, whatever, man. You know, he's a faggot, man. You know, Sean Hannity ain't no fucking faggot. They don't allow faggots on Fox. So that's why you watch Fox? That's good enough reason for me, bro.
Really?
My wife was like, how do you get this kind of shit out of people? I'm like, I ask them simple goddamn questions. And you get the most ridiculous fucking answers from a goddamn conservative sometimes. Really. And when I ask brothers, why do you bother with Alex Jones? Man, he talks about these crazy ass Jews. I'm like, what are you talking about, the crazy ass Jews? You know, because where we are, there's hardly any, you know? I mean, there's hardly any observant goddamn Jews, right? There's no Orthodox people here. And they'll be like, oh, but, you know, the Jews control the world. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? I said, if they control the world and always had, then how did the fucking European Holocaust goddamn happen? How did the Ustashi wipe out so many goddamn Jews then? What the fuck are you talking about? And, you know, it's always this craziness on where they get these, you know, this weird-ass information. And see, and where, like you mentioned, Professor Griff, if we're going to name names, it seems like he goes to the same sources to get his data for a lot of this. Or am I wrong about that?
I'm not sure if I've seen Griff on Alex Jones' show. I don't know. I've heard Alex Jones maybe mention Professor Griff possibly before.
Well, he's had a technique. He's had Larry Pinkney. He's had the Bahamian Diet homie, Dick Gregory. You know,
right.
I mean, he's had quite a few people who normally, if another white dude said that same kind of shit, they'd be mad.
Well, speaking specifically about Alex Jones, I don't think it's very difficult to see where Alex Jones really stands. And I think if, you know, maybe they're, you know, black people are appearing on his show because they feel as if he reaches such a large audience that it's better to come on his show and actually somehow reach those people rather than have black people be so alien from his listenership that somehow maybe that will save somebody's life. I don't know. But it's very clear when I watch or listen to Alex Jones where he comes from ideologically and what his racial perspective is, even though he tries very hard to make it seem as if he's coming from some sort of racial unbiased. I'm very clear on where Alex Jones stands. But speaking about particularly about people like Griff, I know that there is a sincere desire to get as much information to black people as possible that you feel may somehow enable, you know, or spur some kind of action on, but also save lives. And I understand that that's where a lot of these brothers come from. But I think they're not taking into account the very, you know, intellectually lazy culture we live in now. Mm-hmm. You know, where it doesn't, you know, people are not spurred to pick up, you know, or delve into a book list that is going to actually show them, you know, teach them how to actually deconstruct their reality. And that's what we need in very fundamental ways. You know, it, getting into conspiracy theory, you know, that's another, you can get into that philosophy if you like, but that can't be your bread and butter. That can't be how you actually intend to liberate yourself and your people, because that's bullshit. You might as well be reading romance novels. Mm-hmm. Really, because it's the same thing.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Known as Normal. When I founded the organization in 1970 to create a national discussion on the need to legalize marijuana for responsible adult use, no one honestly believed that 36 years later, marijuana would still be an illegal and untaxed commodity. However, since Normal began this important advocacy effort, 12 states have decriminalized the possession of marijuana, and 11 states have passed medical marijuana laws or voter initiatives, meaning that over one-third of the American population lives in a state or municipality that has reformed their marijuana laws. Isn't it time that Congress step in and pass national legislation to reform marijuana laws? Let's finish the job of legalizing marijuana once and for all by you and your like-minded friends joining and supporting Normal's longstanding advocacy. You can learn more about Normal's marijuana law reform efforts or become an active supporter by calling toll-free 888-67-NORMAL or by visiting www.normal.org.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
Niggas. Niggas are scared all of niggas. Revolution.
Niggas.
But niggas shouldn't be scared of revolution.
Niggas. All niggas.
Because
niggas.
Revolution is nothing but change. And all niggas do
all
is change. Niggas come in for murk
niggas.
And change into pimping clothes. The industries to make
niggas.
Some quick change. Niggas change their
niggas.
Hair from black
all
to red
niggas.
To blonde. And old black hair, it looks
niggas.
For change. Niggas kill other
niggas
just because one
niggas.
Didn't receive the
niggas.
Correct change.
Niggas,
niggas change from men
niggas.
To women, from women
niggas.
To men. Niggas change, change, change.
Change.
You hear
change.
Niggas say,
change.
Things are changing.
Change.
Things are changing.
Change.
Yeah, things are changing.
Nigga
things into black nigga things.
Niggas.
Black nigga things that
niggas.
Go through all kinds
niggas.
Of changes. The change in the day
all
that
niggas.
Makes you madden
niggas.
And rave. Black
niggas.
Power, black power.
Niggas.
And the change
niggas.
That comes
niggas.
Over them at night. They sigh and moan.
Niggas.
Right thigh. Ooh,
niggas.
Right thigh.
Niggas.
Niggas always
niggas.
Going through bullshit change. But when
niggas.
It comes for real
niggas.
Change,
niggas
are scared of revolution.
The injustice that has been inflicted upon Negroes in this country by Uncle Sam is criminal.
Niggas,
niggas are actors.
Niggas,
niggas are actors.
Niggas,
niggas act like they're in a hurry.
Niggas.
They catch the first
niggas.
Act of the great white hope.
Niggas
try to act like Malcolm.
Niggas.
And when a white man
actors.
Doesn't react toward
niggas.
Them like he did. can't dig in action. Niggers are scared of revolution.
I'm not an integrationist. Never could be. I couldn't integrate with my enemy. And I know who my enemy is.
Niggers are very untogether people. Niggers talk about getting high and riding around in ales. Niggers should get high and ride to hell. Niggers talk about pimping, pimping that, pimping what? Pimping yours, pimping mine. Just to be pimping is a hell of a line. Niggers are very untogether people. Niggers are players. Niggers are players, are players. Niggers play football, baseball, and basketball while the white man is cutting off their balls. Niggers tell you they're ready to be liberated, but when you say, let's go take our liberation, niggers reply, I was just playing. Niggers are playing with revolution and losing. Niggers are scared of revolution.
We don't want to have anything to do with any race of dogs, two-legged dogs, that will stick four-legged dogs on innocent, harmless women, children, and babies.
Niggas are lovers, are lovers, are lovers. Niggas love to hear Malcolm rap, but they didn't love Malcolm. Niggas love everything but themselves. But I'm a lover too. Yep, I'm a lover too. I love niggas, I love niggas, I love niggas. Because niggas are me, and I should only love that which is me. I love to see niggas go through changes, love to see niggas act, love to see niggas make them plays and shoot the shit. But there's one thing about niggas I do not love. Niggas are scared of revolution.
We declare our rank on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Hello, I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women age 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women and to incorporate access to Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Yeah, I mean that's the way I see it. You know, I mean I'm totally cool, and it is inspiring when, you know, I went back to Philly last year to say goodbye to somebody. Somebody I grew up with, and, you know, there were some brothers that were standing on the corner, and they had on leather jackets and the berets and, you know, the boots and shit, and, you know, they were handing out some literature, you know, and I didn't have time to really rap with them, and I was already, you know, my head wasn't there yet, at that time. But, you know, it was cool to see. But, you know, when I was on my way back, you know, home, and I was like, you know, man, it was, I saw that, and on the outside, it looked cool. But the thing about it is, I had to say to myself, you know, this is not the 60s any longer. And it's not that I'm totally cool with the way things have turned out. I'm not. You know, I'm not at all. I don't like how the Native community looks. I don't like how the Black community looks. I don't like how the fucking Philippine community looks and shit. And, you know, and as somebody who is Ashkenazi, you know, I look at Jews sometimes, you know, the Jewish community, and I'm just like, what the fuck, you know? It's like, I'm related to this shit. You know, it's like, I look at a lot of goddamn things. And that's one of the issues, I suppose, where I was wanted to go to, is that we kind of hinted on this earlier, the emotional content of a lot of this. Now, when I try to educate people, and I don't want to sound like a boorish son of a bitch, well, when I go to educate people, I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot of folks that are just angry. And I'm not even trying to give them direction. I'm like, look, if you look at this and you read this and you look at that, and if you have a problem with this, well, you know, you can use this to get around that, and the library's over here, and there's a computer bank over there that they'll let you sit there for half an hour. And, you know, they're just like, oh, you're talking to me like I'm stupid. And I'm like, look, man, I'm not. You know, it's just, if I told you that you could get your dick sucked over around the corner with this fly-ass fucking girl that would just do it because she just doesn't give a shit and she just likes to fucking do it, you know, you'd be cool with that. That was good information right. for you, right? You know, if I could tell you how to get over without having to study and you could get a degree, well, hey, man, good looking out. Mm. But when I tell a brother to read a book, you know what I'm saying? That you know, that might have some weight to it. You know, it might be a little thick, and it might be on a subject that he doesn't think anyway has anything to do with what, you know, with him. That, you know, folks can get really nasty, and then they start saying things that you didn't say. And then they start insinuating that you insulted them when you didn't. And, you know, a lot of that in terms of dealing with Black people, because Farrakhan has talked about this. The Honorable Louis Farrakhan has said that the Black man and woman on Earth is the hardest people in the world, in the universe, to lead.
Right.
Because it's like, you know, you don't want to accept your condition. You know, it's like you'll accept the negative. But, you know, the idea of you getting out of the negative, well, it's like, I might actually have to be independent. It's not that we don't want to do the work. It's not that kind of shit. I might actually have to think for myself, because you've been going for so long not thinking for your fucking self. You weren't allowed to think for yourself. And people are like, well, you know, I think you're full of shit. I'm like, really? I'm going to lay something to you right now. And, you know, it's a case of, you know, motherfucking, How can I, you know, put this where it's going to make sense? You know, when a woman gets beat, a lot of us say, well, she should have left. I know from personal experience that a woman can't always up and leave. You got children. Right. You got a money situation. Where is she going to stay? You know, if you take a woman that I know, she married a cat. We all tried to talk her out of it. But she's a grown woman. And she said, hey, I like his disposition. That's what she told me. And she married this cat. Yeah, he beat the shit out of her. He was completely abusive. She stayed with him for several years. But her family had cut her off. You know how that goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know how that goes. You want to be with that strange motherfucker, you know, that strange nigga, go ahead. And, you know, she did that. And when she was, you know, people are like, well, why don't you leave? Why don't you leave? She goes, where am I going to go? With three kids. Where am I going to go? You know, with what money? And, you know, and I would, you know, tell this particular story to white people. They're like, well, didn't she have a job? And it's like, what do you mean, didn't she have a job? Yeah, she had a job. But what the fuck she was doing was not going to take care of her and these three, you know. And there was no place to go. And when you look at the little stuff, it costs money to move.
Right.
People don't think about that. You got to put a down payment. You know what I mean? There's fees involved. Credit check. How much they charging for credit checks now? In a lot of these places, they want to do a background check. In Seattle, Portland, they do background checks, criminal background checks on rentals, home sales.
Yeah, absolutely.
You live in a police state. So, you know, if you don't have money to go, you know, to deal with these fees, you don't have time to go and run around and do this type of thing, you know, it's not easy. So, you know, some people can understand that, some don't. Now, it's not that men, a lot of, you know, brothers don't understand that. A lot of them just don't give a shit. because they don't want to give a shit. Because if they have to consider that, then they got to think about their own behavior and their own attitudes that lead to fucked up behavior and lead to fucked up consequences. You know, where people are, you know, in a fucked up position and they end up making choices that they didn't want to make. You know, the people were trying to defend to me because I'm not a fan of Orange is the New Black. You know, and a lot of the people in the gay community upset with me because I'm not, you know, raving about this show because there's a transgender person on it. And I'm like, look, I'm supportive of her, you know, but look at the fucking venue in which, you know, she's, I'm looking for support. A fucking TV show that, it, from a propagandistic sense, is telling people that prison is okay. It's just another transition of social life. You know, you got people wearing orange jumpsuits and shit to the Halloween. That's what happened over here. I don't know how many motherfucking people, male and female, wore goddamn jumpsuits. I'm like, are you fucking stupid? You're black. And here you want to argue with me about mass incarceration. And here it is Halloween. You're wearing a fucking orange goddamn jumpsuit. You fucking make me sick. But then this guy today got on me about Bobby Seale this fucking morning.
Bobby Seale was a sellout. Bobby Seale is a sucker now. Bobby Seale is weak. All this type of shit. I'm like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. You watch all of the negativity on goddamn TV all fucking day long when you're not playing Xbox. And he listens to this show. You're 38 motherfucking years old. You know, so I'm sorry, man, but that's my goddamn position on this type of shit. You know, I mean, I know a motherfucker right now, man. He got on my case because he said that I didn't know. This was when I was in Seattle, because I didn't know what the Seahawks were doing, the football team up there.
Okay.
That I wasn't a real black man because there were brothers on the team and I should be supporting them.
Well, you know, and I feel you, man. I was just having a conversation very similar to this one earlier this afternoon, you know, and, you know, with my lady about, you know, dealing with black folks like this. And, you know, and she, you know, her approach to me was that I was being too hard on folks. And, you know, and I feel like there's enough information, you know, there's enough information and people have enough access that you can get the basics if you are interested. I guess we can't discount the larger culture, the larger dominant culture that we live in. That is a dumbed down culture. It is an intentionally dumbed down culture. And it, you know, obviously has forced our people into a position where we're, you know, obviously a colonized people who are dependent on white folks to lead them. And a lot of times today, white folks are not in a position to lead anyone to information, especially not some information that's going to liberate your ass. Because obviously, you know, I take New York City, for example. Now, even amongst the folks that you've seen marching in the streets, and I've been to some of these protests recently, you know, I see a lot of behaviors within the protest marches of people across, you know, across the board in terms of race. Not just the undisciplined and unpoliticized behavior, but also folks who think that it's a hangout. You know, it's a hangout. It's a new thing. It's a hip thing for them to do because folks are so caught up into this kind of corporatized, hip culture. You know, so they're looking for something. This is the thing now to be a part of. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't obviously a lot of very serious activists that are out there and new folks who are looking to be more serious than they've been. But I'm saying that they are going to have to, and I'll give you an example. One of the protests that I went to, these folks shut down the main shopping square on 34th Street, right next to Macy's. Shut it down. I was impressed. I was very impressed. They did a moment of silence, and I think those, you know, I understand out of respect for the dead, you do that kind of thing. But here in New York City, where people don't speak to each other anymore, where people walk down the streets and they cross the streets staring into the screens of their gadgets, you where men and women largely don't build families because they ain't dating, because the dating scene here is a shambles because men and women don't talk to each other. And those are some of my criticisms too of the sisters who are behind the anti-harassment campaigns, that they don't acknowledge a lot of the alienation that takes place between men and women in large cities like New York, where people just largely don't talk to each other. So my thing with you know, youth and the new youth movement, political movements, is talk to each other, engage each other. You know, in order for people to get to information, people have to actually engage each other. They have to actually be critical of this current culture, and you know, the techno fetish culture. We got to be critical of that shit, because that shit is keeping us, it's turning us into something other than human, and we're already dumbed down.
Well, let me point this out before you go any further. Now, some of you who listen to this show, you know, this is international, know who Weave is. He's a hacker. He's a famous hacker. He's to the point where he's so famous as a hacker that he was, and a troll, which is really what he's known for hacking into people's computers and harassing them and harassing women, I believe. I mean, he was part of that whole Gamergate, thing. Part of it in the sense of that he's part of the genesis of this. His activities have inspired a lot of these young guys to, use what is called rat technology or remote access technology, where they will basically tap into random computers and turn on the microphones and the video cameras. And they look for women that they like, what they were calling rat girlfriends. You know, these are cats that never left their house. They don't have women. They probably can't get a woman. They don't know how to converse. All they know how to do is type. They're just keyboard motherfuckers. Well, anyway, he's one of these cats. And he just came out recently as a white supremacist. Now, since he came out as a white supremacist, and like I said, he represents, even though I'm not saying he's directly a part of this, because somebody's going to take that out of context, but he is, you know, he was part of this whole community of gamers or what have you, and trolling, hackers and whatever the fuck. I guess the dark side of all of that, because some of them have gotten in contact with me to, you know, they wanted me to know that they didn't hate women and they weren't racist or whatever. This Weave cat, he, in my mind, personifies all of this. He's a white supremacist. He's a troll. He's an electronic troll. You know, he's, heavy into this Bitcoin thing. And MSNBC just had him on as a guest on their financial show. But my point is, black people are not looking at that and saying, why is a white supremacist troll, internet troll, who, you know, is about, you know, gaming and crapola like that, you know. What the fuck is he doing on MSNBC, but we can't get a Ferguson activist on MSNBC so that Oprah Winfrey can see that something has happened?
No, this is true. I think there are several people that you see like that, you know, that have those kinds of views, and they very easily make that crossover. I don't know what that guy's name. He's got a YouTube channel. He seems to be some kind of Christian fundamentalist, and he's a white guy. He likes to break down the Luciferian and Illuminati hip hop artists. Mm-hmm. But he also likes to challenge black people by, I guess, going in, you know, running up to black people on the street and seeing how many times he can say nigger before somebody snaps.
Yeah. You know, and the thing about it is that there's a few of them that do that. And they always do the same thing. They have somebody that runs over that's like, this is being filmed. You can't hit me. I'll call the police. You know, and it's like they're out there taunting people and they then say, I'll call the police. And then when, you know, a couple of them, like the cops came and they're like, I have a right to do this. And when you look at their background, they're gamers. You know, they're the type of white guys that I went to school with. They're smarter than everybody else. They always quoted the rules. They broke the rules all fucking day long. But they would quote, when they were caught by instructors or what have you, they would always quote the rules. You can't do this to me. You can't do that to me. Well, you stepped on that motherfucking kid's foot for no goddamn reason and caused him to fucking, you know, yell out and shit. Well, he was a packy and fucking I did it, but you can't do whatever to me. You can't penalize me in such and such a way. I can basically get away with this shit. First, I'm white, and second, there's rules. but they only apply to you. They don't apply to me. And what I try to point out to a lot of black folks who really don't have any experience with white people, they think they do. And really, they worked with a white dude. You know, they drank after work. They got some prostitutes together, maybe. They smoked a joint or whatever the fuck. They know white people. No, you don't. I live deep in the craw of white America. And I'm telling you, you got attitudes out here that are completely fucked up, always have been fucked up, been there, and will never goddamn go away. Some of us are simply acceptable. And you know, a lot of these brothers that are howling about a lot of shit, they don't really think about that. They're not really thinking. All they think is, okay, well, you know, whitey this, whitey that. They're not really thinking, who am I dealing with? Who is it that really has control over me? And how are they able to maintain that goddamn control? And then you have to ask yourself, you, like I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about Bobby Seale in relation to the NYPD, I guess that's what they're calling it, the NYPD cop killings. And I know I'm being a little, well, a lot long-winded, but, you know, which is my nature. And I do apologize to our guest and to everybody that's listening for that. But I do want to point something out because a lot of things go through my mind at the same time. When I was young, there was an attack in New York City. It was either New York or Chicago with three black revolutionaries who I believe they were trying to tie to the Panthers, but it was never proven in court. It was actually one of the instigations for Newkill and Chesimard. You know where I'm going with this?
I believe I know where you're going.
All right. Well, what happened was they made a movie about it, which is why I really remember it. And I remember my father telling me the story because he was hurt by it. There was a white cop and a black cop where they were trying to integrate the police force. Now, like I said, I can't remember if it was New York City or Chicago, but they were trying to integrate the police force. And this was in the early 70s. And they put these two guys together, and of course they have friction, and that's what they showed in the movie. Matter of fact, the white actor Perry King, for those of you who remember Roots, and Mandingo, Ken Norton was the slave in Mandingo.
Ken Norton. You remember Ken Norton.
Yeah, James Mason was the plantation master, but Perry King, the actor, was his son. And he got into one of the slave master relationships with one of his one of the black women there. You know, it was a whole lot of shit. But what I'm trying to get to is, you know, these things from the plantation are still going on. And my opinion is that a lot of black people, I know I'm going on a tangent, but roll with me. You know, a lot of black folks don't really articulate or can't or don't think that they have the right to articulate a lot of this. But where this ties into the shootings that I'm talking about is they made this film with that particular actor. And like I said, I think it's important because he was a white man who made that film. And I believe actually said in an interview that he was told not to make that film. And I encourage people who are into cultural references to go look that up. But in any case, they had their strife in the film show. Well, you know, the TV film show that, you know, they had their strife since you're a white dude. He's being forced to work with this nigger cop trying to, you know, stand up and be right for everybody. So his shoes were shine. You know, he was perfect. He was crispy every time he came to work. Plus, as they got to know each other, like any two human beings, when they're spending time with each other, they normalize. Now, I'm not going to say that they became friends and all that kind of shit. And that's not what the movie tried to make it out, because we're talking about the 70s when there was still some integrity on television in the United States. And again, I'm being long-winded, but what I'm trying to get to the point is that these three brothers in this particular incident that was portrayed in this film shot these two cops as they walked past them. They shot them in the back. Kind of like what we're talking about in New York City. There was no rhyme or reason for doing this. They were not attached to anybody. They called themselves being revolutionary by doing this shit, and all it did was just get a lot of other black men in the fucking city fucked up. It didn't do anything. There was no political gain from this shit. It didn't spark a motherfucking revolution. You know, I mean, people who are even talking about that kind of shit being legitimate, who are looking at Bobby Seale in terms of that, and saying, well, he shouldn't have said this. This is bullshit. We got a right to defend ourselves. Like you pointed out, brother. As Malachi has pointed out, that was not self-defense. That was bullshit right there. That motherfucker was already probably, he was already, his family said he was been suicidal for more than a year. He shot his girl. He was going all the fuck way out. he probably thought he'd probably get a little credit for doing some shit like this, but this motherfucker had been doing things up and down the East Coast for goddamn years. So what I'm trying to point out is that, you know, we have, I feel, being suckered. Because you got the white community that is freaking out about this. You got the cops that are using this as a cause to rally their motherfucking troops as they, I can't remember his, or Pat Lynch, is that his name? Who declared a war basically on Black America. Cause he wasn't even, I don't even think talking about the local New York City PD. He said, we're at war. We're on a war footing with the anti-police brutality protests, which is from coast to coast.
Absolutely. And a not so veiled threat, against Black people in New York City.
Yeah, but well, see, to me, I'm not in New York City, but I take it as a fucking threat, you know, because you got officers out here that are touchy. Mm. They're touchy. Well, you got motherfuckers that, you know, well, really, it turns out it was a gang shootout between two factions, but a squad car was in the middle. So now they're saying that was an example of this anti-police thing. But, you know, the different reports are saying there was really two gangs that were shooting at each other, but they're going to use this to push the mainstream white public in a particular position. And to push the, you know, Black people. I mean, what? Giuliani, who is in no position to say anything. If you look at his record and his connections to the mafia, he's in no position to say goddamn anything when it comes to, Black people should be, what, after the Central Park Five? Is that what they're called?
Right.
I mean, I know a little bit about that case, the Central Park Five. I mean, what happened to that woman was terrible. But when I heard about it in Philly, I remember I was one of the people that said that they need to bang these motherfuckers up. You know, and I'll tell you why I said that at the time. Because I was looking at getting married. And I was thinking, what if that was my wife? You know, who decided that she wanted to fucking jog in the middle of the night. And I'm going to tell you why else I felt like that. Because at that time I had a fucking... And, you know, I had a pretty good goddamn job. And I was bringing home some decent money. You dig what I'm saying? And I was looking at getting married. And I was looking at insurance and shit. And I was looking at, you know, getting my second credit card. And motherfucking, I was like, hey, man, these are the type of niggas I don't want to have to deal with. I'm being straight up with you. And because of the way that they reported it, and at the time the internet was not around, I had to go by what the local police were saying. To the local press and how it was reported in Philly. And I remember reading, you know, the way that they put that out, and I said, yeah, they're guilty. Why did I say that? Well, I grew up in a neighborhood where women were raped. I've seen women run home with no clothes on, bloody. I've seen that with my own fucking eyes. So, you know, it didn't seem to me that it was outside of the realm of possibility. But the point was they fucking lied. They set these young men up. They knew who actually did that, and they kept goddamn going because they were making careers on shit like that. And the Black community, the reason I point this out is I didn't have all of the facts, and I made a judgment on what I knew, and I made a judgment on my social position, and I was wrong. You follow where I'm going with this?
See, but you know what? Another way to look at that, though, brother, and I commend you, man, for being able to say, hey, listen, I was coming from a particular class perspective at the time. It was informed by how good I was doing monetarily, where I was in terms of my social life. And so, you know, that's a revolutionary act in and of itself. But let's look at some of the things that Bobby Seale said as well. Because again, what I learned from the party, man, former members of the party is, you know, obviously no one is above political critique. And if you're a revolutionary, you accept that. And you also accept that your study is perpetual, and that you can always be corrected. Now, again, I'm on board with majority of what Bobby Seale said. It's on point. But at the same time, like I said, I detected a bit of ageism in his commentary, because speaking specifically about the NYPD and having grown up with that organization and not saying, you know, I'm not want to paint any kind of mythical picture of the NYPD, but it is a rotten organization, and has always been a rotten organization, and especially in its relationship to African people and indigenous people. And when I say indigenous folks, I'm talking about the Puerto Rican folks, the Taino and Arawak folks who populate New York and Chicago largely. You know, they have a rogue element within the NYPD and always have. That is, and even you can go on YouTube, man, and look at some of the videos that some of the young brothers in the hood in New York City who, you know, who may, you know, sell weed or sell a little bit of crack, who've actually been recording some of the rogue undercover cops of the NYPD. And these men are insane. And they're allowed to be insane because, you know, because the system, you know, the ruling class wants a certain mad dog element in their police forces. And I think to a degree, what I detect in Bobby Seale's statement is that he's forgetting this element and forgetting that, you know, young brothers and sisters, especially the youth, man, they encounter these beasts like police officers, you know, and so we can't forget that element that, you know, maybe as we get older, you know, and I know, man, when I'm, you know, and I've discussed it with you before, when I move outside of New York City and I may be in a nicer area or even if I'm organizing, it tends to be a lot better when I'm outside of New York City. New York City is its own particular animal, and the level of corruption that goes on in this city now, especially when you have a person like Giuliani and Bloomberg that has been in office for the past, I guess, close to 20 years now, where you have the business class gets to run roughshod over city government. You have an atmosphere in the city that is pretty lawless, in terms of anything official, you know, and where the poor folks are concerned, you are pretty much powerless, you know, and at their mercy. So I think we have to, at the same time, I want to critique some of the youth that you're talking about and some of the brothers and sisters, man, who are very reactionary and romantic and how they approach their politics. At the same time, you know, I think we should have empathy. We should always have empathy for the brothers and sisters, man, who got to deal with this shit on a day. And the night that brother came to New York City, man, and killed those cops, I was actually at a protest, man, with a bunch of black women who actually were trying to shut down a Target shopping center in Brooklyn. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful, man. It was all organized by black women. There was another brother who I knew who was there with an organization called Malcolm X Grassroots. And we were talking about the shooting. And one of the things he said to me, man, was obviously he and I were looking at it as, you know, a reactionary thing. We knew that this man had just shot his girlfriend in Baltimore. But we said to each other, said, you know, dealing with the police murders across this country of black people, it's the kind of thing, man, where after a while, it can make you go a little bit insane. It can drive you a little bit crazy. And I'm not saying that that's the case for this brother who shot these two cops. But, you know, and I'm sure you felt this on occasion where you start to lose track of the names of the murdered, you know, and then you start hearing about children getting murdered. And it can drive you a little bit insane to the point where you're saying you forget your politics for a moment. And you start to say, you know, well, listen, if our children are not safe and our women are not safe and our mothers are not safe, then why do these men and women who represent this apparatus by putting on that uniform, why should they be safe in return? You understand what I'm saying, bro?
Yeah, but there's the, you know, the idea of, well, if it happened to one of them, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, as opposed to motherfuckers saying, hey, man, you know, if you're in the mood to do that, go ahead and do that. Because, see, that's the type of shit that's talked. But, see, the thing about it is that I also want to bring up is that even though this motherfucker's, you know, saying they don't give a shit, maybe it's a good thing, blah, 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 blah. You and I both know they're not gonna do a motherfucking thing. Because as I was saying, as, you know, we were warming up for this, that, you know, these guys will talk all that crapola, but, you know, they had a good chance and, you know, when Ferguson was really live to go down there after, Anonymous made it pretty fucking clear that the Klan and the Oath Keepers were down there. I mean, the Oath Keepers were finally stopped by the police. They were taking positions on the roofs and shit, and the local PD went up there and said, get the fuck out of here. This is not your goddamn job. Who the fuck do you think you are? Or they were like, look, you really can't do this, and we're being told to tell you to go. But regardless, they were moved. But, you know, when the Klan was handing out flyers and shit, I told a couple of these cats down by me, and they listen to the show. I'm not saying anything here I didn't say to you to your faces. Where the fuck were y'all when it came to that? You could have provided security. Instead of standing here wearing the motherfucking latest goddamn, you know, camouflage, you know, of your enemy, standing on the fucking corner and shit, you know, with the big Africa talking about, you know, when we get rid of the faggots, that's when the black family will come together. You're talking all that bullshit. Well, you had time to fuck, you know, while you were doing that, why didn't you take your motherfucking asses to Ferguson and stand security for these people who are being threatened by the fucking Klan? The Klan threatened them, and Anonymous found out, because we goddamn reported it. The Klan, I mean, Anonymous found out that the fucking head of the Klan, Frank Okona, was visiting the fucking local police station and using their computers. This was reported on Facebook. This was reported on Twitter. But the mainstream news didn't say a goddamn thing. And the black community who knew about this, because black Twitter is supposed to be an important thing, right? Black Twitter is supposed to be an important thing. When I go on black Twitter, all I see is white supremacist shit.
Yeah, I see a lot of that myself.
You know, or why do fat white women date beautiful black men and crap like that? You know, what the fuck does that have to do with anything? And then when Oprah comes around and makes her criticism, you know, for the most part, that might be where some of that is coming from. When you look at a lot of black social media, it's a lot of crap. I mean, I've talked about it on the show. You look at the Nielsen ratings. Anybody can download this. You go to the fucking site and download it. They have one package for what they call Americans, right? They have another package for what they call the African-American viewing habits. They have the Asian viewing habits, and they have the Spanish-speaking viewing habits. And the black folks, I've looked at this. I've talked about this with Mosi Ngozi on this show. And fucking, what are we watching? Sports, entertainment, and Fox News. That's what they say. That's what the industry says to each other. If you want to sell crap, this is how you do it. This is who's looking at what. And yeah, with black people in the United States, they're watching entertainment. And Fox News, which is entertainment. You know, so I didn't mean to cut you off.
I was just saying I didn't even realize that black people were watching Fox News to that degree.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that. But we definitely, African people in the United States, we are definitely addicted to television. It's an addiction. It literally is an addiction. I get into fights with people about television. The concept of turning off the television.
Yeah.
And
this is always, you know, in the background.
Right. And I'll tell you, it has a direct contribution to to a degree, the quality of our relationships, because, you know, a people who are viewing their reality through that prism, you know, one, you're going to be crazy. And I mean, it says a lot about, you know, the culture of America in general. But I know folks who are, you know, who are activists and politically involved, and, you know, and they never, you know, I go over their homes and they never turn their television off. You know, it's not the news that's playing. It's BET. It's BET that's playing. And I'm surprised. I was like, I thought a lot of the quote unquote conscious black people stopped watching BET a long time ago.
Well, it's like that in the Native community. When you go into most homes, it's almost the same thing. I'm talking about people who, you know, they're able to maintain a steady income in the Native, you know, the urban Native community. They watch BET.
Wow.
And it's real, well, because I find it a contradiction, because you go into so many homes and you'll hear, you know, and they'll say present company excluded, but, you know, they mean, you know, nigga this, nigga that. Black people, why they do this, why they do that, you know. And it's like, you know, well, hey, you know, you're sitting watching BET, and they'll say, well, that, you know, and they'll give you what it is and why they're saying what they're saying, and that's their reference point.
Right, right. And basically, listen, much of, you know, and I think I might have mentioned this to you before, it was my white housemate in Seattle who, you know, kind of summed up television in the past 25 to 30 years as Nazi propaganda, you know, and to go one step further, much of what we've seen, especially what we're seeing now in terms of reality television, is basically it's setting up black people for what we're experiencing now, so that we are perceived as a people who are not only disposable, but an impediment to the success of the entire country. That, you know, that we are dead weight. That every social woe and ill can somehow be connected to the slowness or inability of black people to assimilate into the American system. And when you see these ridiculous ass reality shows, these are propaganda pieces used to target us. Used to target us to, you know, I mean, because, you know, there's a couple of videos out there of police whipping on young brothers. And as they're whipping on these young brothers, they're explaining to them. They're saying, you know, you're holding the country back. It was there's a video of two young brothers who got stopped in Philly. I don't know if you saw that. And the cop, as he's harassing them and hemming these brothers up, he's explaining to them. He says, you're holding the country back. You're a drain on the country. You know? And, you know, this Confederate ideologue shit he's spouting.
Yeah, yeah, but see, here's the thing, though. You know, like, when I talk about these sorts of emotional, sociio-political contradictions, you get black women who, if they're... husband, boyfriend loses his job through no fault of his own, and he's not able to get on his feet economically. I'm talking about a situation that's, you know, not like how you and I probably grew up, where my father worked, you know, and when I came home from school, there was somebody there, you know, you dig what I'm saying? You know, that housewife shit is long past. And even then, not everybody could do that. But, you know, a lot of these folks will get into, you know, well, it, you know, this was perfect this way, or that was perfect that way. And you ask them, you know, where they're getting these social means from. I mean, my sisters used to reference the Brady Bunch. Hmm. There was no black TV like that. Not for kids, you know, our age group. And while I was more into books, you know, that's what they paid attention to. I watched shit like Star Trek, you know, that had more interest for me. But, you know, that was their reference point. And when you look at a lot of, you know, black folks, you mentioned reality thing. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen Mob Wives.
Yeah, my lady has watched that. So I've been there. My lady watches it, then I'm in the room, I'm watching it too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just like me. That's how I got caught into that shit. My wife will say, hey, you know, cause we don't have a TV, but she's like, look at this, or Basketball Wives, look at this shit, you know. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, whoa, here's all these Italian women and one Albanian talking about their husband going away. He's a career criminal, career gangster, you know, mafioso, father going away, grandfather done time, and they're crying and breaking down. And I'm thinking, you know, it's funny. I wonder if I sat a group of, just average, supposedly white Americans in a room and played Mob Wives and Basketball Wives and then took, I don't know if you're aware of this, but a lot of this type of reality shit when it comes to, like Mob Wives, like, you know, crime cinema or crime, media, I guess it's a new thing now.
Very large.
Frey Brothers, and you had their fans and followers, their fan sites and books about them. They were two twins. Well, really, two twins and a third brother that ran, the east, side of London for quite a long time. Billy Whitelaw, for those of my international listeners, especially my UK listeners who remember Billy Whitelaw, she just passed on. And, she knew the craze personally. Not that that matters. But
anyway, okay.
Cultural reference. But in any case, you know, I mean, I know the names. So, you know, I know who these people are, but they glorify their gangsters. And I was always flipped out about this. You know, the police respect them to a degree. I mean, you had somebody like Frankie Fraser, probably the most famous Native American gangster ever. He was a British gangster from the East End who was part of the Richardson Gang, which was opposite of the Cray Brothers. But his family was from Canada. he's actually part Native. He's probably the most famous, most violent fucking Native American gangster in Native American history. But he was a British gangster, fucking Mad Frankie Frazier. And you had the Cray brothers, and you had these guys. I mean, they would sit on British television and talk about how many people they did in and how much dope they sold. I mean, you know, Paul Harris, totally different on how things are dealt with outside the United States. And black people here are not asking themselves why we're still talking about Assata Shakur, while we're still having a massive police brutality issue in the United States. And we don't look at the fact that the Bader Meinhof, those who didn't commit suicide, they're out. They've been out. Right? Sure. The, you know, the Red Brigades, all of that that was happening during the strategy of tension in Europe, they're out. And you got IRA people that have been out.
Right.
They run for office now, Sinn Féin.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely.
Right? Jerry Adams, what have you. You know, you look at Spain. You look at the Bosch. You look at, you know, the ETA. You look at what was happening with the Ustasha in Croatia. You look at Russia. Why is it that the black man and woman in 2015 is not on a political even keel? When we know, well, you and I know that the Black Panther Party used to liaison with the PLO and the IRA both.
Right. Well, I mean, it's obvious, you know, the class and ideological divide amongst black people, and you have the kind of, I guess what people call the Boulé element,
yeah.
who are, you know, hopelessly,
yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, you got the hopelessly servile, element, which people like Oprah and Bill Cosby, they're part of that class. And their interest, they're not interested in that level of political power. They belong to the pawn class. You know, they don't mind being pawn, well-paid pawns. You know, it's not about power. Because power is dangerous. You know, power is dangerous, and it actually, like you said earlier, it actually requires you to take responsibility for your own destiny. And the most educated black folks in this country have no interest in that. They have no interest in that, and so they, by and large, do despise the element of the revolutionary element that came in after the civil rights movement that they support, which was in many ways many perceived as a middle class political movement. Although it was, under examination, that's not entirely true.
Well, yes, yeah, like a lot of folks who still get confused, and, you know, it's hard to tell them that MLK did not start the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
he was thrust into it. You know, he didn't start jack. He actually had to be pushed. Which is still even then pretty funny when you get the folks who want to talk to you about the Illuminati all motherfucking day long, but they can't tell you about the, and I'm forgetting his name right now myself. But the cat that executed MLK's mother in church, he was black.
That's right. And that story is largely not even known.
Nope. Or how his brother, A.B. King, was found floating in the fucking family pool wearing a full suit.
Hmm.
Or the fact that during the Freedom of Information request, I forgot who it was to find this out. But the FBI there, no, Hoover's FBI, after they, I guess they dealt with Marcus Garvey, they were following MLK's grandfather.
Hmm.
So, you know, that he was evidently, you know, a black man who, as a minister, was always, you know, talking about, you know, a Garveyite type of policies and so on. So that's how long they have been following that family. Look at all the shit that came out about Tupac Shakur after he was we don't know what the fuck really went on with Tupac Shakur, really.
Right?
You know, I mean, right. That's a question right there, too. You know, who was his family? What was his lineage? And even though I've been criticized for criticizing him, and I don't, I meant every word that I said. He acted like a thug and he went out like one. But there was still a political machine that was running in the background. He was being surveilled up until the moment that he was shot.
Right.
And who was sitting next to him? You know, and what is his relationship to a lot of this? Who was backing him? I mean, when you look at Death Row Records, and I encourage everybody who gives a fuck about the rap game to look at Welcome to Death Row, if you've never seen it. and look at how, you know, two black men, one, you know, we all know about Michael Harris. If you know anything at all about the crack cocaine thing that was happening under Freeway Ricky Ross in L.A., you have right. to know who Mike Harris was. And he bankrolled, matter of fact, that's how Denzel Washington got his career. Because he was, you know, a dealer, a drug trafficker in the black community. And he was trying to go legit. And he was, you know, funding, plays on Broadway in New York City and some other cultural things because he was like, hey, you know, I ran ahead and made this money because I got put into that position. I'm not in that position. So, you know, I'm dealing with that right now, really, because he was incarcerated while he was doing all of this. And Suge met him, knew him, because he was a legend in L.A. This is what is in the documentary. So here these two black men start this company, this firm. And what ended up happening? You know, white people control that whole business entity, what's left of Death Row. And what kind of message was put out by their music? And yeah, there's artistic this and that. Yeah, there's that whole reality of the hood thing. Yeah, I got all that already. But you know, we're talking about, you know, really looking at the socio-political aspects and how the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense came about in Oakland, had a militant stance, but they had discipline. They had officers that were out in the street. They had field people in the prison system. There was discipline. The leadership was gone. What happened? We got the Crips and the Bloods. And not too many people really want to deal with that. And see, and this is the type of thing I say to these revolutionary brothers and sisters. I'm like, okay, fine. You want to talk about violence as an option. Okay, fine. Politically, I understand where you're coming from. But are you really looking at the byproducts of when you start that type of action? I don't think a lot of you are looking at that.
I mean, the question of, you know, and these are, you know, working with former members of the party and the Black Panther Collective. These things were a part of our political study. We had, you know, for the community, we had weekly political education classes, and for ourselves, often there was more. And, the question of violence, was a study. The question of spontaneous violence, was a study, was a part of study. You study every aspect, and you have to study how violence is used in a political movement, when and if violence is used in a political movement. It isn't a reactionary spur of the moment or I felt like doing kind of thing. As a revolutionary, it's violent. It's violence is not even when you may perceive that it's necessary. There is a study behind the act of violence in a revolutionary movement. And obviously we don't have, you know, there are very few organizations that can put this study two people, one of the few organizations, and we talked about it, I think the last time I was on with you, was the Uhuru Movement. I encourage folks to reach out, you know, if you want a political education, reach out to the Uhuru Movement and, you know, at the very least, you will get a basic, political understanding, you know, and understand what your relationship is to the larger society.
The Uhuru group that he's mentioning, MPETA, they're actually holding, as we speak, it started today, a citizens, black people's grand jury hearing in Fort Lauderdale, I believe, on this issue, in terms of police brutality and where we go from here. I haven't seen anything like that since the black congressional, not the black congressional, because they didn't support it when it went down. When Leroy Jones had the black meeting, I think it was 1973 or 75, there was a black people's conference, and I believe it was Gary, Indiana, and it was led by Leroy Jones. He was the chairman. And there were delegates, and the black congressional Congress didn't really want to deal with it, because the point was to have this meeting, because the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense had called for a plebiscite. So Leroy Jones, who was the only black member of the Beat Writers, right? I know a lot of people don't think about that. You know, before he became Amiri Baraka, he was still Leroy Jones, and he led that.
See, okay, I was confusing that with the Black Power Conference, I believe, that happened in 69 in Newark, New Jersey.
That was another one. And yeah, his family's from Newark, and he was down with that, unless we're talking about the same thing. And I have my locations wrong.
But it was a major conference.
I believe you're right.
It was a major conference.
I understand.
You know, I mean, there's so many powerful black folks who were never on TV, never on the radio, that kicked ass. And, you know, when we think about the criticism that's happening to Oprah right now, who I really don't give a fuck about. I'm not dissing her. I don't give a fuck about it, you know. But I'm just saying, you know, I just find that this knee-jerk reaction about this, you know, really odd if people knew their history. If people really knew their history, and then, you know, when you try to, you know, talk to them about it, it's clear that they don't know their fucking history. That they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. They believe that they do. And, you know, and I think this has a lot to do when we want to talk about, you know, the white culture, you know, speaking from, you know, a perspective of being black people in the United States, or say the United States and Canada, or even the United States and Mexico, because that is North America. You know, and there was an issue, and we should talk about that too. And actually, I'm going to tie this in. I know I'm going on a tangent, everybody, but please roll with me. You know, we had a Latino cop and an Asian cop get shot. Don't tell me that that's not causing tensions between the black community and the Asian community in New York
City. Well, it's definitely being used as such. A lot of the coverage that I've seen here in New York is definitely pushing. You know, obviously, you know, there's no way to getting around the fact that this was a Latino and Asian that were killed. But it seems to be that the police, because quite honestly, many of the police that turned their backs on the mayor were obviously mostly white and also Latino. And historically here in New York City, especially in the Bronx, there was a closer relationship with the Irish and Italian community and the Latino community in a very, I would say, particularly in the Bronx, a very harsh schism between, you know, African Americans and, you know, Puerto Rican folks. I think less so in the other boroughs like Manhattan and Brooklyn. But where you go into Brooklyn and the Caribbean communities, there seems to be this sense of competition between, you know, Caribbean blacks and, folks from Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. And, you know, it's very interesting. Someone wrote a piece that I actually came across on Facebook talking about the history of the NYPD and obviously as an Irish immigrant organization, and the relationship between African Americans and the Irish in the United States, and particularly in New York City and probably Boston and I guess maybe Philly and Chicago. And what's interesting about that, the Irish kind of perceiving blacks initially as competition and someone who is in a way taking food out of their mouths. I see the same thing happening between black people and Mexicans. Which is very interesting. Well, I think it's obvious in a racist society, it's probably a natural progression. But, my encounters recently in the past recent years, and obviously we saw, Malcolm X's grandson, get killed in Mexico, not too long ago. I've had some very interesting encounters with young Mexican brothers, particularly young Mexicans, that tells me that they also perceive me as probably some kind of impediment, similar to the Irish, to their position in American society. And obviously that's manipulated. That's obviously the nature of a capitalist and a colonizer society. but these are things that also need to be examined, obviously, so that, you know, that we can have a clearer understanding of how we're going to be manipulated and how we are being manipulated.
Well, yeah, because, you know, my wife was pointing out that all of a sudden she's hearing white, you know, people who never talked about ass before, who would look at a sister that was kind of healthy in the backside and say, oh, she's fat, no matter how solid she was, right?
Right.
You know, how the black female form has always been fucked with. And then here it is now. We're watching some of our neighbors who are getting butt jobs.
you know.
Right.
And it's really not, you know, black influence, because that's, you know, black people have always been here and our women have always had that build, and it was always something that was mocked. The Hottentot was always mocked. But because of Latino culture, because they pay attention to ass, even though they deny the blackness in them, especially when you talk about Dominicans, especially when you talk about Puerto Ricans, right? Puerto Ricanos, right. Boricua, right? When you start getting into those areas, then you start to get into racism again, but racism that they learned from Spain and Portugal, as opposed to the racism that you and I are dealing with, that came primarily from England, right? In terms of a provenance, because, you know, the racism that they're dealing with is like, well, what the white man, as they say in Brazil, the white man in Portuguese, the white man eats at the table, the Indian eats on the floor, the black eats outside. That's the pecking order of Brazil. And people who would tell me who have been to Brazil, I've known plenty of people who go to Brazil that like to go for Carnival. You know, men who are single that like to go, they like to go for Carnival. I can understand why. But the thing about it is they're only going there for Carnival. They're staying at a pretty good hotel. They might get themselves a girlfriend over there. And I've known fellas who had taken advantage of that. They hooked up with a woman who didn't have too much, that they will pop in on, you know, every 3 or 4 months or so. You know, I mean, you know, real talk. You got white men that do it in the Philippines. They do it in Thailand. They do it in Hong Kong all the time. They got second, third families. You know, so this is not uncommon. But, you know, the thing about it is, as you pointed out, capitalism, exploitation, you know, the class aspects, how race, you know, refers to the class aspects, as the communists like to put it, right? But then you and I have the position of looking at this as descendants of slaves, who know that we were slaves. It's not a matter of being ashamed of it. It's not a matter of being proud of it. But we can definitely move from an objective viewpoint in terms of our objectivity, saying, well, we're coming from this base. We recognize that. And in relation to that. But at the same time, you said that you had a white roommate. I've lived with white people for many, many years. And, you know, when you're dealing with them on the other side, you look back at your own community and you're like, well, wait a minute, you know. Why are we doing this, that, and the other? But see, instead of looking at that as, you know, asking questions, a lot of black folks, or a lot of people, if you're a Mexican and you ask Mexicans, why do you hate black people? Why is it that black people in Veracruz and Oaxaca are disrespected? Why do we hate Indians, where most of us have Indian blood? You know, you get a rejection. You hear Latino writers talk about this all the time, that when they ask these questions amongst their own people, they're not respected. When Germans talk about the Nazis, what happens to them? When the Japanese talk about Nanjing, what happens to them? When the Chinese talk about Tibet, what happens to them? So where are black people, you feel, in this as a, you know, as an ending thing to this, and how we could, say, move to the discussion further, to move the analysis further? But we can do this without, you know, people feeling bad and thinking that they're being demoralized and demeaned, because that's really what's happening to Bobby Seale and really Oprah. Instead of, you know, analyzing what's happening and say, you know, where are they coming from? What was their viewpoint on this, and how would their analysis change, being that they've been in the movement for so long, in terms of Bobby Seale anyway, been in the movement for so long, as opposed to what we see now in Ferguson. You know, and since we mentioned Mary Baraka and people like that, you know, where do we move on from there? In terms of a George Jackson, where people will hear about George Jackson and get stuck there and don't move any further.
You know, one of the things that, you know, one, I just want to, I want to congratulate a lot of the youth that I've seen out in the streets here in New York in the past couple of months. You know, so, you know, I definitely, you want to support the youth whenever they can and they come out. I definitely hope that, folks want to move beyond a lot of the cheering and the rhetoric and the die-ins, and recognizing that, you know, there was a movement here, and actually people who have been working around police brutality and police murder, for years. When I came into the movement in 94, 95, there were people who had been working on it a generation before. And so those people have value. And obviously Bobby Seale has value. Someone, you know, I tell you the truth, in terms of the comments of Oprah Winfrey, again, Oprah's a celebrity. You know, I, you know, again, as you were saying, you don't give a fuck. I don't really think much about what people like Oprah Winfrey think. Honestly, I don't really think a great deal about what people like Bill Cosby think. But there's always room for self-criticism, you know, self-criticism and criticism. You know, these are revolutionary practices. And like you said, in order to move forward, you do have to have a certain level of self-critique. And so a lot of, I think, what we've talked about in our discussion today in terms of a lot of our folks not going deeper, not moving beyond maybe if they've read anything at all, not moving beyond one book. You know, not actually, to be quite honest with you, not joining an organization. Many of the people who I converse with, whether it be Twitter, on the street, Facebook, whatever, I ask them, have they ever been a part of an organization, any organization? You know, even a white communist organization, which, you know, I used to actually warn a lot of youth who were in colleges, you know, about jumping into a lot of white socialists and feminist organization before they had actually worked in their own community, because I just felt like it really put them in a bad place in terms of not just identity, but in an ability to actually engage people of their own race and culture. I think it's important, you know, a lot of times when I engage, you know, the feminist sisters online, it may seem sometimes that I'm being overly antagonistic with them, but a lot of times I'm trying to get to the point where a lot of them see if you're going to take a certain kind of, you know, I guess liberal, progressive, American stance on gender, fine, but engage your people. Mm. Engage your people. I don't want to, you know, if I ask you what organization, have you worked with an organization before, you know, I don't want you skirting around, you know, don't skirt around the issue. I mean, deal with the fact that you haven't dealt with your own people. You know, if you're going to offer this criticism, that's fine, because obviously a lot of criticisms are valid, but you do yourself a disservice. You do your movement and your political critique a disservice if you have never engaged your own people, you know, and then, you know, the critique is responded to as, well, you're insensitive. Well, you're coming from a patriarchal stance just by offering a critique. No, that's, you're being intellectually dishonest and you're hiding. And the same for those young brothers that you critique who want to, you know, run around and offer you all kinds of bullshit for confronting them about the fact that they're not really engaging politically. You know, and a lot of us are, you know, and so many folks on Twitter, Black Twitter is so fucking engaged in celebrity worship and celebrity culture and celebrity banner. It's like the past 30 years, due to the vacuum of Black leadership and Black organizational presence, we have become a people who are solely engaged and view our world and existence through celebrity. And that's bullshit. That's bullshit. And you can't run from that critique. You can't run from that because it's the truth. You know, in terms of where we move from here is people need to talk. And people need to see this technology. They are tools. These are tools. You know, this is not supposed to be the be all and end all. This is a tool. It should not define your identity. Technology should not define your identity. Social media should not define your identity. And marching in the street cheering is not political organizing. It's not political discourse. You actually have to discuss with people. You have to actually challenge people on their politics. You have to be challenged on your politics. And in order for that to take place, people have to actually discuss things with and discuss some very uncomfortable things with each other, you know. And it's not also about just about coalition building either, because I see a lot of young activists in New York are very focused on coalition building. you know, and coalition building a lot of times, you get wrapped up in that. That's just another way for you to run away from your own contradictions and the contradictions of your so-called comrades. You know, my view on it, brother, is movement comes from analysis and discourse and challenging your own politics and challenging the politics of those who say that they stand with you.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, I've tried to address that here, you know, talking about, you know, the white ally, and I'm down with the white ally. You know, I mean, the Black Panther Party was about the white ally. You know, we had to ally ourselves with the Chinese, with the Tibetans, you know, with the people who want a just world. And, right. You know, Malachi Daniels, I'm sorry we held you as long as we did.
No, it's all good, brother. It's all good.
You know, but, you know, thank you for being on. And, you know, what do you got going online right now?
Online, I tell you, it's a good thing. Much of what I'm doing right now is not online. You know, because of the protests, you know, there've actually been, you know, some meetings to go to and, you know, people to meet and actually plan with. And so there are actually things taking place. I can offer myself some criticism. There isn't one particular organization that I'm working with right now. You know, and maybe that's, you know, wholly a criticism on me. But, to be perfectly honest, I haven't come across an organization just yet that I feel is, going to allow me to use my particular gifts. And I've worked with several political organizations in the past, but, I am enjoying being a free agent at this point.
All right. Well, you know, hey, man, you know, work, you know, in a way that is, you know, emotionally works for you, that, you know, you have some kind of an idea that there's an end to this, that works for, you know, the people whom it's supposed to work for, and is not fitting into a historical, paradigm that really doesn't work for us. But at the same time, you know, what I got from Bobby Seale was, you know, you have to at some point not work with the system, but parley is not a bad thing. If he was able to, you know, have a white officer give them documents that help them in court cases, that's the way you build nations. You know, see, the problem is, of course, is when you deal with a system that doesn't want you to move any further. The Palestinians got political. They did, you know, and they stopped that. Right? Mm-hmm. Iran tried to get political, whatever. You know, they still got their problems, but, you know, they stopped this, which means that they didn't want to deal with that at all. And of course we're dealing with that here, but we still need to understand the function and basis of what it is to actually have a nation and what that means and what we actually have to do in order to do that and how we have to configure our heads, you know, even spiritually, I suppose, in order to be able to deal with that new reality, because it would be our responsibility. And you can't keep blaming white people for all of that, for everything, forever.
No, you hit the nail on the head, brother. I mean, politics and political engagement is about nation building. And that's being left out largely for the youth who are either they're jumping into this now or have considered themselves kind of militant in the past, is that they're not being engaged on that level and challenged to think of themselves as folks who are going to build nation.
Yeah. Okay, on that point, Malachi Daniels, you can find him on Twitter with Deaf Peace.
All right, peace. All right, brother. Thank you.
Be cool.
Take care.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginal.
America del Norte, broadcasting to the fourth world from within occupied North America.
Estás escuchando a los indios Angry sobre los sistemas inteligentes aborígenes radio.
Ellos llaman a dar la vida por nuevo.